And we are in 1 Samuel. I think at the end of chapter 15, unless I'm mistaken. Hope it gets far enough to show you all something tonight.
All right, 1 Samuel. First Samuel chapter 16. Now, this passage has been regarding, of course, Saul's wrestling with this evil spirit from the Lord, and we've discussed all of that at a good bit of length. And so the last thing we talked about in verse 23, and it came to pass when the evil spirit from God was upon Saul that David took an harp and played with his hand. So Saul was refreshed, and we talked about the music thing some, and then it talked about Saul being refreshed. And the last thing we talked about was just the study on the refreshing things of the Bible revolve around, first of all, rest, and then secondly, you can apply music. There is also the hearing of the Word of God from Isaiah 28. And then seven times in the New Testament, the brethren are supposed to be refreshing to each other. And so I hope that's the case. And was well, and the evil spirit departed from him. Of course, he didn't stay away for all that long. We can go on to chapter 17, verse 1. This, of course, is the famous passage about Goliath and so on and so forth. And again, there's a couple of cool things that I actually ran some numbers on, so I'd hope to get to that tonight. But there's a couple of interesting things that leap out. It's such a often read narrative that maybe you don't think there are any great secrets here involved, but we'll see. Now the Philistines, verse 1, gathered together their armies to battle and were gathered together at Socoh, which belongeth to Judah, and pitched between Socoh and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and pitched by the valley of Elah, and set the battle in array against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on a mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, talking about on the two sides of the valley, and there was a valley between them. And so this is a fairly, you know, secure encampment. So you have enemies, and you know they're both camped on mountains opposite with a valley in between. And so, you know, they can camp there in relative security for an army, because anybody that tries to attack them has to attack them uphill, which is not a good thing, preferably in war. And so the idea being they're camped here, and there's kind of has to be an agreed time where they're going to come out and go to and fight one another in the valley. Verse 4, and there went out a champion. This guy is called a champion three times in the passage, and this is the only champion in the Bible, a Goliath. There went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath. Okay, being of Gath, well, that makes him a Gittite. So you know of Ittai the Gittite. Well, that was from Gath, so that's what somebody from Gath is. Named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. What most folks say a cubit is, and it's probably right, is the length of a man's elbow to end of fingers, you know, forearm. Supposed to be about 18 inches, of course, depending on, you know, the height of the man and the length of the arm, I suppose. And there's just a possibility that what happens if we're measuring the giants by the giant's cubit? A giant's elbow to end of finger is going to be longer than mine, right? And so he could be bigger than we even think. But 6 cubits would be 9 feet if 18 inches is the standard cubit, and a span. And a span is supposed to be from the tip of the little finger to the tip of the thumb, roughly 9 inches. And lo and behold, I measured, and mine is 9 inches. So I'm normal. So he's 9 feet nine or possibly more. There went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. Now, interestingly, most folks talk about David and the giant. Goliath is never called a giant. Let me show you. I think giants show up 21 times, but he wasn't a giant. He was the offspring of a giant. And there could be a difference there. Look in 2 Samuel 21. You don't find Goliath called a giant. 2 Samuel 21. All right, let's start reading with verse 15. You're going to meet four sons of the giant. Moreover, the Philistines had yet war again with Israel. And David went down and his servants with him, fought against the Philistines, and David waxed faint. And Ishbi-benob, which was of the sons of the giant. So these guys are sons of the giant. And the giant is not mentioned who exactly he is. Presumably, just a giant that dwells among the Philistines, okay? Now, we know in Genesis 6, there were giants in the land in those days. These were the offspring of fallen angels and women, okay? And exactly how this works is a little bit questionable, because that was in part the reason the Lord destroyed the earth in Noah's flood. And yet there are still giants that show up. So I'll talk about a few more here in a minute. But Anak was a giant. And the giants were known by various names among the various peoples. And so whether that means after the flood that these fallen sons of God once again cohabited with women, I'm not quite sure. I'm just making the point tonight that Goliath is technically not called a giant. In fact, Ishbi-benob, verse 16 of 2 Samuel 21, is not called a giant. But he did, the weight of whose spear weighed 300 shekels of brass in weight. So 300 shekels. A shekel is supposed to be, if the conversion is right, it might not be. A shekel is 0.025 pounds per shekel. So it's a lot less. It's a 40th of a pound. So the weight of whose spear weighed 300 shekels. What's 300 times 0.025? Okay, so it's still a fairly heavy spear, although Goliath was more. He, being girded with a new sword, thought to have slain David, but Abishai, the son of Zariah, succored him and smote the Philistine and killed him. Then the men of David sware unto him, saying, "Thou shalt go no more out with us to battle, that thou quench not the light of Israel." Came to pass after this that there was again a battle with the Philistines at Gob. Then Shabbekai, the Hushathite, slew Saph, which was of the sons of the giant. There's another one. There was again a battle in Gob with the Philistines, where Elhanan, the son of Jair Oregim, the Bethlehemite, slew the brother of Goliath, the staff of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. So there, what you're confirming here is that Goliath had brothers that were sons of giants. And so apparently he's the son of a giant, so that's why he's nearly 10 feet tall. Verse 20, and there was yet a battle at Gath, where was a man of great stature that had on every hand 6 fingers and on every foot 6 toes, 4 and 20 in number. He also was born to the giant. So there's 4 guys here that are born to giants, and then we have Goliath, who is the brother of them. So he was the son of a giant, apparently. Verse 21, and when He divided Israel. Jonathan, the son of Shimea, the brother of David, slew him. These four were born to the giant. And then, since Goliath is already dead, apparently that's why they didn't mention Goliath there, other than to say that he was a brother. But it doesn't anywhere say that that Goliath was a giant. So 10 feet tall guy is not a giant. Apparently his father was bigger. So that's kind of interesting. All right, down in verse 4, he is, and I'm back to 1 Samuel 17, he's 6 cubits and a span, and he had a helmet of brass upon his head. He was armed with a coat of mail. Now, you know, that's interlinking like chain mail. And the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels. So, again, using the best I could come up with for a conversion was 0.025 pounds. A shekel is 0.025 pounds. So multiply that out. He's carrying around 125 pounds of just chain mail. Now, I know Marines and Rangers carry heavier backpacks than that at times, but I don't think they're running around doing hand-to-hand in those packs. This guy has 125 pounds of chainmail. Wait till you see his spear here. And he had greaves of brass upon his legs and a target of brass between his shoulders. We think of between the shoulders as in the back. I don't know if he had anything in the back or not. It sounds like a breastplate he has on his front. This up here is between his shoulders too, right? Not just in the back. So that's what I think it is, but that's what I think. And a target of brass between his shoulders, verse 7. And the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam. His spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and one bearing a shield went before him. Okay, now think about this. Now, I was a shot putter in high school and college. In high school, we threw a 12-pound shot, the men did, and the boys did. And then when I moved to college, we went up to a 16-pound shot. That's what, you know, Olympic quality, that's Olympic quality weight. So a shot put is 16 pounds. This guy's spearhead is 15 pounds. I promise you, running around all day at a track meet, carrying your shot put around, it gets wearying. Think about throwing a spear with a 15-pound head on it. A javelin, Olympic javelin, weighs less than 2 pounds. And I know a lot of guys that injured themselves because I used to throw javelin too in college. And you can really easily tear your shoulder and elbow up because actually when you're running down a runway and come down to a complete hard stop trying to throw that javelin as far as you can, you know, there's an awful lot of stress on elbow and shoulder. Now think about, and the world record in that, by the way, is 323 feet. So there's a guy in Sweden that can throw a spear, a javelin, more than a length of a football field. Okay. I don't know how far Goliath could throw his spear, but that spear had a head on it that was 15 pounds. So that's a real man there, right? Just to impress you, I got some other things maybe later to impress you with, I'm not sure. But verse 8, and he stood and cried unto the armies of Israel and said unto them, why are ye come out to set your battle in array? Am not I a Philistine and ye servants to Saul? Choose you a man for you and let him come down to me. One man makes all the difference. Verse 9, if he be able to fight with me and kill me, then will we be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then shall ye be our servants and serve us. Well, again, you don't have to play by his rules. But verse 10, and the Philistines said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. Now, just a reminder, back when Israel's wanting a king, really bad, right? Go back to chapter 8, verse 20. Look what they said. We want a king, verse 19, last phrase. Nay, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. And they got a king that wouldn't go out. Right? I mean, if anybody was there that, you know, should have answered the call, it was Saul. He was taller than anybody else, right? By the way, he comes from Benjamin. It's the Benjamites who later are the guys that left-handed can sling a stone at a hair's breadth. And Saul's from Benjamin. So they're warriors. They had to be because they were survivors, right? They're the ones that got, you know, taken down by and almost eradicated by the rest of the tribes. But Saul wouldn't step to the plate. So verse 11, when Saul and all Israel heard those words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now David was the son of that Ephrathite, not Ephraim, but an Ephrathite is a Judean. Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and he had 8 sons, and the man went among men for an old man in the days of Saul. And the 3 eldest sons of Jesse went and followed Saul to the battle, and the names of his 3 sons that went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, the next unto him Abinadab, and the 3rd Shammah. And David was the youngest, and the 3 eldest followed Saul, but David went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. So at the time, he's not actually being a court musician in court. Then while Saul's out on the battlefield or whatever, he's home still keeping sheep. Verse 16. And the Philistine drew near morning and evening and presented himself 40 days. Once again, a month and a half, the armies of Israel are stymied. A month and a half, this guy comes out and blows his mouth off, right? Verse 17, and Jesse said unto David his son, take now for thy brethren an ephah of this parched corn and these 10 loaves, and run to the camp to thy brethren. Carry these 10 cheeses unto the captain of their 1,000, and look how thy brethren fare and take their pledge. This is a little bit reminiscent of Joseph going to look for his brethren at the behest of his father, right? And David doesn't receive a very warm welcome from his eldest brother. Down in verse 19, now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. Okay, so they're in a battle array. There's not a major battle going on, but they're still fighting. I'm assuming that means at night there are probably patrols. You know, they're testing the defenses, you know, trying to figure out a way to run each other off the mountain and so on and so forth. I'm assuming that's what it means. Verse 20, and David rose up early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper, took and went as Jesse had commanded him. He came to the trench, and the trench is going to be something the men are in, something to protect them from arrows, you know, that might be shot from one position to another. Saul was sleeping in the trench when David went in and stole his armor later on, okay? The idea is it's a fortified position and a below ground, so it's hard to lob something in there and kill somebody. Verse 20, and he came to the trench as the host was going forth to the fight. Now again, there's not a full-scale battle between them, but apparently they still go out and get in battle array, and there's some skirmishing that goes on, I guess, and shouted for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had put the battle in array, army against army. And David left his carriage at the hand of the keeper of the carriage and ran into the army and came and saluted his brother. And as he talked with them, behold, there came up the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name. So second time he's called a champion. Out of the armies of the Philistines, and spake according to the same words, and David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. And the men of Israel said, have ye seen this man that has come up surely to defy Israel? Is he come up? And it shall be that the man who killeth him, the king will enrich him with great riches and will give him his daughter, make his father's house free in Israel. Now, they're not just talking to David there. Notice in verse 25, the beginning of the verse, have ye seen? So there, this is the saying among them. Verse 26, and David spake to the men that stood by him, saying, what shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine? So They say that among themselves, David hasn't heard it yet, and taketh away the reproach from Israel. For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And the people answered him after this manner. So that's what they would have told him, the same thing as in verse 25, saying, so shall it be done to the man that killeth him. And Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spake unto the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David. Okay, well, you kind of expect that from Eliab. After all, it was just last chapter that Samuel bypassed him as king and anointed baby brother. That couldn't have gone well. You know how brothers and sisters are, right? That couldn't have gone well. That pipsqueak baby brother, you know, got anointed over me, firstborn go-getter brother, right? So there's that. And spake unto the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled, verse 28, against David, and he said, why camest thou down hither? And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? A disparaging, you know, remark. It's a big brother syndrome. It's like, again, kind of like Joseph and the other 10 brothers. I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thine heart. Now, wait a minute. That pride was obedience. Back in verse 17, his father told him to do it. That pride was obedience. And furthermore, I know the naughtiness of thine heart. David was the man after God's own heart. So what you should draw away from that is when you're trying to do right, somebody maybe quite close to you is going to have a problem with it. Right? Especially if they think that you're more spiritual than they are. Verse 28. For thou art come down that thou mightest see the battle. And David said, what have I now done? Is there not a cause? And he says, what's the problem here? Is there not a cause? And he turned from him toward another and spake after the same manner. And the people answered him again after the former manner. And then when the words were heard which David spake, they rehearsed them before Saul, and he sent for him. So it says something about Saul here, right? One guy shows up who's kind of a kid, and he says, I'll go fight him. And Saul says, bring him here. Hurry. Right? It's kind of sick, you know, when you stop and think about it, right? Here's a guy probably 7 feet tall, and he's going to let a kid go to battle for him. Verse 32, and David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Thy servant will go and fight with the Philistine. And Saul said to David, thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth. A little bit later after this battle, Saul calls David, verse 56, a stripling. A stripling is technically defined as an adolescent who has gone through or is going through that gawky stage, you know, more length and clumsiness than muscle and all that kind of stuff. Stripling. And now he's calling him a youth. So, you know, I don't know whether David's 17, 18, 20, or 22, but, you know, in Saul's eyes, he still thinks of him as a kid. Verse 33, thou art but a youth, and he is a man of war from his youth. And David said unto Saul, thy servant kept his father's sheep. There came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock. And I'm not sure why my Bible does this, but this is an old Holman Bible, and sometimes it helps me out in the margins by telling me what a better translation would be. And so it has David took a kid out of the flock. A kid is a goat. A kid's a goat. A lamb is a sheep. So it's, you know, trying to... David's not protecting sheep anymore. He's protecting goats. And it's not the same. Verse 35, and I went out after him. Now he says, both a lion and a bear. I'm not sure which one he's talking about. I guess it really doesn't matter. Because he did both, right? I mean, Saul's not only not going out to fight Goliath, but he also has never fought a lion or a bear, right? So I guess one thing you could learn from this is that, you know, tending to the things that the Lord calls you to tend to is good training for what might come later. I guess you can learn quite some lessons about courage and bravery and being valiant, I suppose, even from keeping sheep. So that reminds me of that passage. What is it? Luke chapter 16. Luke chapter 16. It's easy for us to dismiss monotonous stuff. Luke chapter 16. And going down to verse 10. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. I mean, it's a broad principle. And so, you know, you can't really be trusted with, you know, magnanimous things if you can't be trusted with minuscule things. If you can't save pennies, then you can't save dollars, right? And so the idea here is David attended to his business, and because of what he went through with the sheep, and even that nobody maybe even knew about, I don't even know if his brothers knew about this. You know, he was ready for Goliath when he came. So you need to take seriously the monotonous things that you have to go through. And you know, let's face it, sometimes being in church is monotonous and dealing with the brethren can be monotonous and all those sort of things. Well, you learn some valuable lessons with that, because someday you might need mercy. And someday there might be a broader, more valiant battle to fight that you won't be prepared for if you haven't taken care of mundane, arcane things, right? Back to verse 35, and I went out after him, smote him, and delivered it out of his mouth, the lamb out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and smote him. So this is not just, he didn't just kill a lion. He killed a lion or a bear, well, both presumably, hand to hand. That's yet another layer on top of this David thing. What guy goes out and tries to save a baby lamb from a lion? That lion in Palestine might have only been 130 pounds, you know, more like a leopard, a cougar, something like that. A bear would have probably been more, probably not a grizzly, probably not a 900-pounder, but still. You know, you see attack dogs that weigh 100 pounds and they're more than a handful, believe me, right? And so it's not a small thing. So, you know, I'm sure Rambo probably killed lions and bears barehanded. I don't know if he did or not, but I know David did. Verse 36, and thy servant slew both the lion and the bear. I don't know if that's the same time. And this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. David said, moreover, the Lord hath delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear. So he didn't give his credit to whoever taught him martial arts or whoever taught him to use a sling or anything else. He gave the honor to God. The Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of the Philistine. And this Philistine. And Saul said unto David, go, and the Lord be with thee. I mean, Saul is desperate. It's kind of sad, really, right? I mean, he's going to send essentially a late teen out to fight the champion of the Philistines. He's the king who was hired to go out and fight our battles. It's just weird. Verse 38, and David, Saul armed David with his armor, Saul's armor, and he put a helmet of brass upon his head. Also, he armed him with a coat of mail. It must have been pretty funny looking. Saul's, you know, 6'10 or so, and here's David, still a stripling, wearing Saul's big old oversized, you know, armor. And he took his staff in his, no, I'm sorry, verse 39, David girded his sword upon his armor, and he essayed to go. He tried to go, for he had not proved it. In other words, he's going to take it out for a trial run. He goes outside the tent and makes a couple of turns kind of jogging and then tries to sling a stone in the mail, and it ain't working out for him. And so verse 39, and he essayed to go, for he had not proved it. And David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not proved them. And David put them off him. The outstanding thing that I see there is you don't need to go to battle in the armor of a guy who won't use the armor. You know, I mean, Saul's going to give him his armor. Saul doesn't use it himself, but he'll give somebody else the armor to fight in. That's not real good, right? Verse 40. And he took his staff in his hand and chose him five smooth stones out of the brook, put them in a shepherd's bag, which he had even in a scrip, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. I want to make sure and get this in, because this is pretty good. May it cross your mind, you wonder if a sling is really that dangerous a weapon. Right? I mean, plainly, it'd be hard to be accurate with it. You'd have to work a lot, so he has worked a lot. And don't forget that there were Benjamites that could fling a stone at a hair's breadth left-handed and hit with it. So plainly, they were trained ambidextrously. And I've never used a sling, actually. I'm actually thinking about doing one because I did some research this week. Can we agree that probably a 9mm applied to the right part of the anatomy of Goliath would have taken care of him? Probably can. So how do you compare a handgun to a sling and a stone? Well, as it turns out, there's a formula where P is momentum, and its momentum is mass times velocity. This mass, we'll do it tonight in grams, usually measured in kilograms, and velocity is going to be meters per second, okay? So you take a 9mm pistol and 125 grain 9mm bullet weighs 8 grams. Okay? So you have 8 grams, and multiply that by the velocity of a 9mm bullet is 1,200 feet. What? I did that wrong. Feet per second. Okay, if we're going to put it in millimeters, since they have this in metric, that is 365 meters per second. So times 365 meters per second. And what that comes out as, since I can't do it in my head, is a number 2920. And this will be 2920 grams per meter per second. And they want it in kilograms. It doesn't matter. The number doesn't mean that much. So it would be, that number would be 2.9. Okay, doesn't sound too impressive because it doesn't mean a thing, right? I mean, you have to have something to compare it to. Fine. Here we have the sling. And this is cool. Okay, you got to figure out what you're going to sling and how much the weight of it's going to be, the mass of it's going to be. Jim had a golf ball tonight for some reason. Some dumb reason, I don't know why. A golf ball weighs 46 grams. Okay? So, if you think about how much a golf ball weighs, if you go down to the brook and pick up some nice round rocks about the size of a golf ball, if the golf ball weighs 46 grams, it's easy to round numbers and say, let's just pick up a rock that weighs 50 grams, okay? And you got to multiply that, you got to figure out how fast you can sling a stone. So I go and research it a little bit. There was a guy on there that, you know, as an older guy, maybe older than me even, imagine that. And he said from the start, he said, I'm not a good slinger. He said, I've just done this to try to figure out how fast I could sling a stone. And so he tries it several times. Now, first of all, he's using kind of a short sling. Now, he's using a sling that's only, when folded, only about this long, okay? And he's slinging it, and he's trying to measure the velocity. He finally gets it to go in the right hole so he can measure the velocity. He was flinging it about 35 meters per second. And then he said it too. I was looking further, and there were some guys that were plainly trying to apply the principles and trying to be good at it. One guy was hitting a target the size of the offering plate, you know, from here to midway back. He was using a big old long sling. It must have been about 4 feet long, folded. So, you know, it's way out here, and he's slinging it, and he's missing a lot. But when he finally hits the metal plate that size, I mean, it disintegrates the rock. And he was flinging it at 60 meters per second. Now, that doesn't sound too impressive, but when you multiply 50 grams times 60 meters per second, can you do math in your head? 3,000 meters per second. And if you want to make it kilograms, so the comparison is 2.9 with a 9 millimeter, 3.0 to a 50 gram rock. If you went up to a 60 gram rock, you got 3.6. It's pretty amazing when you stop and consider that. I mean, you say, well, it's not going to go as far. Well, no, and it's not going to penetrate as deep. When you hit somebody in the forehead, you don't need it to penetrate deep. It kills you just as dead with something this big, and it, because it has more momentum. So it's pretty impressive. I think I'm going to go get me a sling. Might not be really good for close work, but anyway. So it's not a small thing for him to carry this into battle. Let's find a quick place to close here. Five smooth stones, verse 40, out of the brook, put them in a shepherd's bag, which he had even in a scrip, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistines. The Philistine came on and drew near unto David, and the man that bare the shield went before him. And we can stop there. We'll get into some more stuff next time. But I thought that was cool. Yes, sir.